Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Laura.
And I'm Amity. Let's get started.
So we are super excited today to dive into The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. My kids said to me they had read this book in high school. I've never read it. Had you read it before now?
Yes, also in high school. So it's been a while. Addie read it just of her own accord, and then she had it assigned in high school, and then she's read it a couple times since. She likes it a lot. It's good. I don't think that Tate has, it has not been assigned to him quite yet. I want to say they're juniors before they read it.
Yeah, I'll have to ask my kids when they read it. But I was thinking this would be good for, it'd be fun to do stuff that a lot of high schools read. So I wanted to give a little bit of an introduction about the author, F. Scott Fitzgerald, just briefly. So he grew up in Minnesota and he went to private school, and it said that he was a mediocre student. He wasn't a very good student, but eventually he went to Princeton and they actually put him on academic probation. So he continued to not be a very good student, but he eventually enlisted in the army, and then he met and fell in love with Zelda Sayre. And she said, I'm not going to marry you until I know that you can support me. And so he went on to publish his first novel, which actually was his most successful. It was called This Side of Paradise. And he published that in 1920. And then a week later, she married him. So it worked.
Wow.
Yeah. And then they moved to Paris. And that's where he started working on The Great Gatsby. The Great Gatsby did not sell very well. So interesting, right? That this is the one that has like stood the test of time, but yet at the time was not very popular.
I think it's one of those things sort of like artists are not appreciated in their time, but as long as we hold on to their works over time, we appreciate their brilliance.
Yes, like is it Van Gogh and like those kind of artists that during their time did not have success, but then later they did. But
especially those ones who were not doing the normal and acceptable art of the particular time.
Right. And this may not have been.
Yeah.
Again, they moved to Paris and he started working on The Great Gatsby. And then they came back to the United States in 1927 and he published a bunch more novels, but none of them did as well as his first one. So that's kind of interesting. And they had a really ritzy lifestyle and they were in debt their whole married life. And so he was constantly trying to make up for that. And I know that he tried to write screenplays. He failed at that. And so that didn't go well. And so eventually they had alcoholism problems and mental illness.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I don't think their later years were great. Eventually he died of a heart attack in 1940. And then 8 years later, his wife died in a fire.
So his granddaughter, Jesmyn Ward, did the introduction to this version that I have. And the little bit that I was able to read, she talked about that. She talked about how she never met her grandfather. I think that her grandmother died in that fire maybe like a week after she was born, something like that. So they both died fairly young, right? Does it say when he was born? If he served in World War I, he couldn't have been terribly old at that point. And then he died by 1940.
Well, he went to Princeton in 1917, but I bet you, you know, I've heard of his granddaughter before. I've never read anything by her, but Jesmyn Ward, she's a famous author. 1896 is when he was born.
1890. Yeah. So he wasn't even 50, right?
Yeah, it would have been 44. I just turned 44 this week.
So young. Like,
that's like, scary. That's crazy.
Yeah. Rough life.
Yeah. I don't think, I feel like I'd be ready to die of a heart attack. So that's sad.
Well, and it's interesting too, you know, you talk about them living their ritzy lifestyle. And so many would think, oh, you know, that's so hard. But like living with the stress of being in so much debt, you may as well live in poverty. That would be awful.
Which is interesting because that's a lot of this book is written about people who are in a ritzy lifestyle. So
yeah,
absolutely. Very interesting.
A little bit about the setting. Obviously, he died in 1940 and this is not a futuristic novel. And so it does take place in the early 20th century. It's about, I want to say 1922, just because that's when Nick Carraway goes to the West Egg. We'll talk about that a little bit more. As I begin, I did want to just inject here that because The Great Gatsby is so well known, and it's one that is commonly read in high school and in colleges, you know, if you major in literature, probably you're going to read it more and study it more. And you have many different opinions. There's many people who have done so much research on it. And so we're not trying to reinvent the wheel, and we're not necessarily trying to disagree with anybody and their opinions, but we are drawing on the beauty of what a classic is and the fact that they are very often just open to interpretation. And so we're going to like summarize the chapters the best that we can and draw from it what means something to us. I've seen and heard lots of criticism about it, lots of things that people, through the lens of their experience, draw back to. They're saying that Fitzgerald is like being extremely critical of the United States as a nation. I can see that maybe that could be a thing. I've seen where people have said that, well, he's extremely misogynistic. We're just going to draw our own conclusions. That's all.
I like that, because I was feeling like a lot of pressure. Like, as I'm reading this, I'm like, I don't understand like the symbolism or whatever. So you're just going to get what we figured out, enjoyed about it or whatever. We're not preaching that we know everything.
Yeah, not at all. We're just trying to apply it to our own experience and learn what we can, because again, a lot of times classics give us sort of a mirror to ourselves and help us learn more about ourselves and about human nature. And I think that that's really what we're trying to do and accomplish here, is learn more about humans, about ourselves, about history, about so many things as we go through these classics. So, okay. So chapter one, this is told in first person, and Nick Carraway is our narrator. He's a very interesting character, and we'll talk about him quite a bit. I love sort of the opening quote he gives. He talks about his dad and something that he said. Whenever you feel like criticizing anyone, just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had. And he said, I understood that he meant a great deal more than that. I'm inclined to reserve all judgments. And he said that because of that attitude, he found that as he went to college and things, people just like opened up to him. Some people thought he was a politician because he liked people and he listened to people and he sort of reserved judgment. He was like not this super strong personality in the room necessarily, but somebody that everybody felt like they could talk to and tell their story to. And it was really interesting too, because he said, I realized by some unmistakable sign that an intimate revelation was quivering on the horizon. Like people would start to tell him things and he'd be like, I don't know if I want to know that. It was just the way he is. And I think that that's a really incredible way to begin the book too, because I think that we have a tendency as we read The Great Gatsby to like harshly judge a lot of these characters. We can be poor and still have advantages that these rich people don't have. It would behoove us to reserve judgment on every character in here, because I have to say that, like, as I was reading, I was like, Nick Carraway needs to like grow a backbone and actually like be a strong person. But that's kind of his way of moving through the world, isn't it? Is like just seeing how things are going to play out and just listening.
Yeah, he's almost just there to like experience the story to tell us.
He is. He's experiencing the story to tell us and not really injecting himself into the story much at all. He's not a strong part of the story. He said that his tolerance does have a limit. He said that Gatsby, the man who gives his name to this book, was a person who represented everything for which I have an unaffected scorn. He said, if personality is an unbroken series of successful gestures, then there was something gorgeous about him, some heightened sensitivity to the promises of life. As if he were related to one of those intricate machines that register earthquakes 10,000 miles away. Really, what he's kind of doing is criticizing Gatsby for pursuing the American dream. And also, not only that, pursuing this girl forever. And locking her into youth as well, not allowing that she can change, and he has changed. He does draw quite a bit of judgment towards Gatsby. Now, this part, he talks about just his background. He said he grew up in the Midwest, and he said the Carraways, that's his last name, he's Nick Carraway, they're something of a clan, and that his grandfather's brother, so his great uncle, had paid someone to go fight in the Civil War for him. This was something that was done And you can think what you want about it, but it was done. If somebody wealthy was drafted and they called up their number and they said, you've got to go, they could pay a farm boy to go for them. Right or wrong, it happened. And so he paid somebody to go for him, and he stayed at home and started a hardware business, which led to generational wealth. So he said he himself served in the Great War. He did go. When he came back, he learned the bond business, and then he headed east. He wanted to go to New York City. It sounds like he's pretty intelligent and did a good job. To me, the bond business, it's finances, and it sounds like it's a lot of crunching numbers and kind of dry. Probably makes some pretty good money doing it, and he seems like just the person to do that. Anyway,
everybody wanted to go west because that was like the land of opportunity, and the, you know, they wanted to work for their money. And then they all decided they wanted to go back east to live off of their relatives. I just thought that was interesting. So he actually went west and then came back east.
Yeah.
To be a bond salesman. And like everybody was going there to become a bond salesman.
It's like selling pest control.
Yes. It was the new employment that everybody was seeking, you know?
Yeah.
New thing. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you're right. He says, everybody I knew was in the bond business. So I suppose it could support one more single man. I think that all of his family was pretty hesitant about it, but, you know, I think he really put his head to it and was determined to do it because he lived in a house for a little while with another guy, but then the guy pulled out and at the last minute, the firm ordered him to Washington and I went out to the country alone. Yeah. So it's 1922. He's back east. He was supposed to basically share rent with this guy and they were supposed to live in a house together. At the last minute, the man was called to Washington by the firm. So he finds himself all by himself and living in the West Egg, which I understand is on Long Island, which apparently, and I've been to New York a couple of times, but I am not have to be there a lot to actually be familiar with it. But I understand that Long Island is quite a bit more rural, or at least suburban.
Yeah. Are these places real? Like West Egg and East Egg?
Oh, I don't know about that. Okay. I'm not sure. I should have looked it up, but all I know is that Long Island and Long Island Sound are real.
These two islands are shaped like eggs and they're shaped the same, but they're so different from each other. That was the shape was the last commonality they had.
Yeah. And that's important. The West Egg is supposed to be sort of looked down on by the East Egg. The East Egg is very ritzy and uppity and West Egg not so much. It just talks about how he does lots of reading. He did meet a guy. He was very lonely. Then he randomly met this guy who was like, how do I get to the West Egg village? He was able to give him directions and get him there. And he suddenly realized, oh, I know my way around. And there was like this freedom that came with that. He realized, oh, I'm not stuck because I know my way around. And he was able to get books. It says that it was a matter of chance that I should have rented a house in one of the strangest communities in North America. Again, it's on Long Island Sound. And like you say, there's the West Egg, the East Egg. The phenomenon about them was that they were dissimilar in every particular except shape and size. And here's where he jumps into that. He says, I lived in the West Egg. It was less fashionable. He says that his house was at the very tip of the egg and it was like squeezed in between these two just mammoth houses. He said the one on his right, I'm going to go ahead and read what he says because it's important. It says the one on my right was a colossal affair by any standard. It was a factual imitation of some Hotel de Ville in Normandy with a tower on one side, spanking new under a thin beard of raw ivy and a marble swimming pool and more than 40 acres of lawn and garden. It was Gatsby's mansion. I don't think he really describes what the one on his left looked like, but he does say that his house was like an eyesore. It was just this tiny little thing. I know that it wasn't literally touching the houses on the right and left, but I just imagine it. Just maybe I've even seen some of those like old pictures where there's these two big buildings in the middle of a city and they're like this tiny little apartment that somebody just squeezed in there. It was like, oh, look, there's already two walls. All we need is a roof and a back wall and a front wall and we'll call it a house, you know, just in that little alleyway between the two buildings. Anyway, that's kind
of what I pictured, like these two really nice houses in this little tiny house that maybe was there before. I don't know, but is it like a shack?
Yeah, probably. And the thing about it too is he happens to have landed right across from his cousin, Daisy Buchanan, who lives on the East Egg. Daisy is married to Tom Buchanan, who Nick had actually known in college. And he'd spent some time with Daisy, but wasn't like terribly close with her, but close enough that, you know, it's like you find yourself in the same town as your cousin. You're like, oh, we are related. I maybe don't know you that well, but we have blood in common. So I'll come see you. His cousin Daisy and her husband Tom, they are ridiculously wealthy. Tom just came from money. He didn't really do anything himself. Sounds like he kind of just wasted away his days. It was just old money. One of the evidences of the fact that he had lots of money is because he had just bought a whole string of polo horses. I'll be totally honest, I don't know what the significance of that is. I mean, obviously it's for the game of polo, but are polo horses especially expensive? Maybe, because they do require some special training, I guess, but that doesn't mean a lot to me. Probably back in the 1920s, it would mean something to people. And then this part is really interesting. He says that he didn't know why they ended up in the East. And this really gives you kind of an idea of the kind of people they are. They had spent time in France for a year for no particular reason. They drifted here and there unrestfully. And he says, I felt that Tom would drift on forever, seeking a little wistfully for the dramatic turbulence of some irrecoverable football game, because he had been a football player. So he goes over to their house. He pulls up and Tom is standing out on the porch, and he's just this pretty massive, muscular human. It's just very aggressive and abrupt. You know, and somebody who thinks very highly of himself, even though everything that has made him who he is came from other people. Mm-hmm. He himself hasn't done really anything. Yes, he played football. Probably a lot of money went into that too.
Well, and they said that that was his peak.
Yeah. All that he had to say for himself. But he is this super muscular guy. But he notes that he has kind of a cruel body. He speaks with a gruff, husky tenor. It just seems like he has contempt towards everybody, even the people he likes. He sort of has this contempt for them.
And people didn't like him.
No, like, people
Nick
didn't
is like
him.
Oh yeah, a lot of people at school didn't really like him. They hated his, they says he hated his guts.
Yeah. They hated him, but I always had the impression that he approved of me and wanted me to like him with some harsh, defiant wistfulness of his own, probably because he just wanted somebody to like him, because even bullies know that people don't like them. And usually that's one of the reasons they're bullies. Everybody actually does want to be loved unless they're a total psycho or sociopath. I love this though. So Nick goes up to him. He's on his porch. Nick goes to greet him and he says, I've got a nice place here. And there's your like one of many red flags. Nobody says that. He didn't wait for a compliment. He just said, oh yeah, I have a nice place. Oh, neat. And then he kind of like shows it off to Nick.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that, something like that to me, like ever. I mean,
no,
maybe, but I mean, just maybe not that bluntly.
I do have an uncle who does kind of remind me of Tom Buchanan. Super wealthy. Now, he is self-made for sure. And so that's to his credit. Definitely like, oh, look at my awesome house. Let's go look around and I'll show you my awesome house. You know?
You know, there are people like that. You're right.
There are.
They might not say that, but they're like, would you like a tour?
I mean, and there is a difference between like, I'm so excited about my new house and I'm so excited to have you guys here and I'd love to show you around, instead of this house is awesome and you should want to see it. They go inside. Obviously, it's a huge house. And they go into this room where two young women are sitting and they're dressed in white, and it is Daisy, his cousin, and another lady who we find out her name is Jordan Baker. And as soon as he's introduced to Jordan Baker, he's like, I know I recognize that name, but I'm not sure why. Something interesting he says about Daisy is that she speaks in like this murmur. People say that Daisy's murmur was only to make people lean toward her. Some people like criticize that, but he's like, actually, it's very charming. He's introduced to Jordan Baker. There's Daisy. And he says that Daisy starts asking him questions, and in her thrilling voice, her low thrilling voice, it was the kind of voice that the ear follows up and down. Her face was sad and lovely with bright things in it, bright eyes and a bright, passionate mouth. But there was an excitement in her voice that men who had cared for her found difficult to forget. A singing compulsion, a whispered listen, a promise that she had done gay, exciting things just a while since, and that there were gay, exciting things hovering in the next hour. So she really is this very alluring, charming, interesting woman who is totally dismissed by her husband. She's kind of gotten to the point where she's begun squashing herself as well, because I think he's dismissed her for so long. We also find out that Daisy and Tom have a little girl who's 3 years old. And something that always upsets me when learning about the past, and especially wealthy people, they can say they love and adore their children. They spend no time with them. Their children are no part of anything. And it's really disturbing and sad to me. They sit down to this meal and Tom is like, "What are you doing, Nick?" He says, "I'm a bond man." Tom says, "Who are you with?" I told him, "Never heard of them." And Nick says, "This annoyed me." And all he says is, "You will. You will if you stay in the East." And that was probably the best thing he could say. But that's just how Tom is. And this kind of reminds me of other people that I know. It's like, well, I haven't heard of it, so it's probably not important.
Yeah.
Which is so frustrating and annoying. And it's like, do you have any idea how big the world is and how small you are? No, you don't. So they're having a conversation. Miss Baker says, "Okay, so you live in West Egg." She says it rather contemptuously, because like we said earlier, the people in East Egg really look down on the people in West Egg. But she says, "I know somebody there." And he says, "Well, I don't know anybody." She's like, "You must know Gatsby." All of a sudden, Daisy is in the conversation. She's like, "What, Gatsby?"
They do this. Gatsby is this super mystery man, right? But everybody seems to know something about him.
They think they do.
They know his name.
Yeah, they know of him. They know his name. And then, of course, he's like Davy Crockett or Daniel Boone. Like, all these stories are told about him. Yep. Everybody knows his name, but nobody really knows him. They just go on. They have like this kind of pathetic little conversation. The whole time I was reading it, I was like, these people are so sad. They have absolutely no meaning in their life. They're just talking about nothing. Something Daisy said is, "Let's plan something. What should we plan?" She's like, "What do people plan?" You know? Like, oh my gosh.
This world to me, because I'm so busy and so, you know, trying to figure out how to get everything done. In a way, this world sounds kind of wonderful. Like, let's plan something. Let's do this. And I'm like, wouldn't that be nice to just be like, wait, how do you plan something? Like, they just have no clue what reality is, you know?
Yes. And I do agree that for a time that would be nice. And then I think I would go crazy.
About a day.
You know? A bit. You know, maybe like 2 days to like truly recover. But then, I couldn't do it.
Usually around our anniversary, David and I will go away for a couple of days. It's at Christmas time, so it's hard. So we'll go before or after Christmas or whatever. And like one time we went to the coast and we just like literally I read and he watched movies for 2 days. And I was like, I think I was made for this. But I would be really tired of it. I mean, that was about long enough, you know? It might have been 2.5 days, but I was like, I never do this. Like we just got to like sit around and do whatever we wanted. And there was nobody asking for food and no work to get done. It was fantastic. But I think I would be tired about it in about 3 days.
Yeah, I think that we would crave some stimulation and some challenge. And again, just some meaning.
Well, maybe that's why they were creating all this drama, is because they had no meaning.
Had nothing else to do, for sure. Yeah. So Tom, then he starts going off about these books that he's reading, which again, just paints him as such a nincompoop. Like, he's such an idiot. So he says, "Civilization's going to pieces. I've gotten to be a terrible pessimist about things. Have you read The Rise of the Colored Empires by this man Goddard?" What we find out is he says that if we don't look out, the white race will be utterly submerged. So this author that he's reading is talking about how concerned they are that black people, just people of color in general, will rise up and take over the white people. And there's just this general outcry and fear about this. This is horrifying. He says, "It's up to us, who are the dominant race, to watch out, or these other races will have control of things." I love Daisy's response. She's like, "We've got to beat them down." And she's like winking ferociously and says,
"Well," and I love what she kind of dismisses him. Like, Tom's getting very profound. He reads deep books with long words in them.
Like, yeah.
She's just kind of dismissing it. Like, it's funny.
Deep books with long words in them. But it is, it's kind of a way of being like, yes, I know my husband is a complete idiot. Don't listen to him. And it's also, I think, a way that Fitzgerald is saying, this is something that was quite prevalent. Look how idiotic it is. And I'm embodying the idiocy in this total loser of a person. So you can understand where I stand on these things.
So the phone rings.
Okay, yes.
And then the butler leaves to go get it. And I just love this. How Daisy like is like, now that the butler's gone, I'm going to tell you a little story about him. And yeah. About him polishing the silver.
And then losing his nose and giving up his position or something.
Yes.
Yeah. So while Tom is gone, Daisy is like, I love having you here.
So then the butler comes back and says that the phone is for Tom. He needs to go answer it. So then Tom leaves the room.
Yeah.
He like, the butler comes in and whispers something in Tom's ear. Tom frowns and then he gets up and goes inside.
But then Daisy goes in and I'm looking.
Yeah, she follows him, doesn't she?
She does, but why am I not seeing that?
So he comes in, she leans forward and she tells Nick, gives him a compliment.
An absolute rose.
Yeah.
Then suddenly she threw her napkin on the table and excused herself and went into the house.
Yep.
Okay. So then just he and Miss Baker are there and he tries to like start up a conversation with Miss Baker about Gatsby. And she's like, shh, I want to hear what's happening. He's like, what do you mean? She says, you mean to say you don't know? I thought everybody knew. She's like, Tom's got some woman in New York. Yeah, and she might have the decency to not phone him at home. Tom and Daisy come back in just a few minutes after that. And Daisy, they're trying to act completely normal. Daisy says this. She says, it couldn't be helped, cried Daisy with tense gaiety, which tells us that she is totally acting, I think. I think it tells us that she's totally acting, that she's trying to act like everything's fine. Nothing is amiss. Nothing's wrong. All is well. And she immediately starts talking about the outdoors and how wonderful it is. But the phone rings again and Daisy's like, no. She shakes her head at Tom and is like, no, you're not doing that. And Nick is like very aware of what's going on. And he says that he wants to look at everybody square in the face, but not look at anybody's eyes. It's just so awkward. Okay. Tom and Miss Baker like exit. They go to the library and he and Daisy are alone. And he just can see that she's very, very troubled. Obviously, he asks some questions about her little girl just to try to like lighten the mood and change the subject. And all she says is, we don't know each other very well, Nick. Even if we are cousins, you didn't come to my wedding. He's like, I was at war. She says, that's true. Well, I've had a very bad time, Nick, and I'm pretty cynical about everything. Then I think we get some pretty sad stuff here because she does start talking about her little girl. She said when she gave birth to her daughter, Tom was not there at all. Now, at that point in time, like men weren't even allowed in the room, but he was, it sounds like he was just completely absent, even from the hospital. And she said immediately she asked the nurse if it was a little boy or a little girl. The nurse said it was a girl. She said, so I turned my head away and wept. All right, I said, I'm glad it's a girl. And I hope she'll be a fool. That's the best thing a girl can be in this world. A beautiful little fool. And she said, you see, I think everything's terrible anyhow. That's where I go, okay, why would somebody think that F. Scott Fitzgerald was trying to paint women into a corner or anything like that? Yes, he described a lot of women of his time and things like that. But I think he gives us this commentary of life is not fair for women at all, especially in the 1920s. I mean, because she's like, you almost have to be stupid in order to survive. And it reminded me a little bit of, this is horrible, but it's true. You know, dogs, the smarter they are, the harder they are. They take a lot more work. You have to get them out and exercise. You have to do things to keep their brain engaged, or they start, the smart ones are the ones who tear apart your furniture and your shoes and things, right? When they're past the puppy stage, they're a lot harder. I know my sister, they purposely got a dog that was stupid so that it would be much easier to deal with. Like, it's a beautiful dog. It's a great family dog, but it's a stupid dog. It can sit for hours and hours and just stare. I really think that that's kind of what he's saying here. What Daisy is saying is an intelligent woman is unfortunately a threat to a lot of men. They will do everything to subdue her and keep her down. And a foolish woman is so much easier. And so she's kind of gotten to the point that she acts foolish because it's just easier.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. Because I think sometimes, if you ever know couples where, like, say the husband is mean, and do you ever wonder, like, does she know? Does the woman know that he's mean or not treating her right? Or does she just think this is how women are treated, right? And so it's like almost in that time, if men were treating women that way, it would be almost easier if they just accepted it and were a fool.
Yeah.
We should have gotten a dumb dog, now that you say that. I was thinking that too, because like one time I went and looked at a dog years ago and David was like, I think there's something wrong with that dog. Like he doesn't see. And I'm like, now I'm thinking, well, yeah, if he just laid around, that'd be great.
They'll go for walks just fine and stay with you just fine because, they're not like.
So that's smart. We have an Australian Shepherd and he's like, he's blind now, but. What's funny about him is when he was a puppy and even till he was blind, he was really hard. But we have a gate on our stairs. So there's like three steps and then a gate. And we have to keep it closed because he's blind and he'll fall down the stairs. And then he'll also go upstairs and like eat the cat food, which then makes him really itchy. But anyways.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's bad. So every time he hears somebody go up or down the stairs, he checks the gate. Every time.
Oh, my gosh. That is amazing.
Maybe somebody left it open and then I can go upstairs. It's like it's his job. Like, I gotta check the gate.
Totally. Oh my gosh. That's amazing though. Yeah. Like, the thing is, like, smart dogs, they're also incredible and
they're hard. So you need a smart, really obedient dog. That's what you need.
Yeah. Let that dog. Which takes like really careful training. But anyway, yeah.
Yes, that we were not good at.
Us either when we had our very smart dog. So this is really interesting because, you know, it's almost like she opens up and is spilling her heart for a minute to Nick. And then all of a sudden she goes back into her actress mode. She's acting all the time. Yeah. You know, most of these people are. She said, in a moment, she looked at me with an absolute smirk on her lovely face as if she had asserted her membership in a rather distinguished secret society to which she and Tom belong. It really is just her acting face. He finally realizes who Miss Baker is. She's Jordan Baker, and she is an athlete, a pretty well-known athlete. She is a golfer, okay? Like, there's not very many sports that women could participate. There just weren't, like, tons of sports in general that were, like, super popular in America. But women were not allowed to participate in a lot of sports. Golf was one they could do, and she did, and she was, like, a pretty famous top-tier athlete, it sounds like. She leaves because she has a tournament the next day. And Tom says after she leaves, he's like, she's a nice girl. They oughtn't to let her run around the country this way. And this is where Daisy's mask drops for just a minute. And she's like, who oughtn't to? He says, her family. Yeah, that obviously like would sort of be very grating for any woman ever probably to be like, they shouldn't let her run around the country. You mean like she just needs to be kept home in a little bubble all of her life? I don't think so. But this is his way of thinking. And Daisy, and a lot of people's way of thinking. And Daisy's like, oh, don't worry. Nick is going to watch out for her. So they give a little bit of background on her. And then Tom, again, sort of illustrating the jerk that he is, says, did you give Nick a little heart-to-heart talk on the veranda? Says this to Daisy. Here's her little acting girl. She says, did I? I can't seem to remember, but I think we talked about the Nordic race. Yes, I'm sure we did. It sort of crept up on us. And first thing you know, don't believe everything you hear, Nick, he advised me. Then we get just a tiny little bit more insight into Nick. We find out that he was engaged to a girl who lives out west, not quite engaged, but almost there. And Nick is like, well, I'm actually too poor. But he keeps giving hints along the way that there's quite a bit of a relationship there. Let's see. He says, you can't stop going with an old friend on account of rumors. And on the other hand, I have no intention of being rumored into a marriage. Then he says that he leaves. He finally leaves. He says that he was confused and a little disgusted as he drove away. It seemed to him that the thing for Daisy to do was to rush out of the house, child in arms. He's like, she wasn't going to do that, though. Like, it was pretty obvious. She was just going to stay there and put up with all this crap. And Tom was just a complete jerk. Anyway, he gets home and he sees this man like walking around the lawn in the of the house next door, and he realizes that it is Mr. Gatsby. He said that he was going to call out to this guy that he is pretty sure is Mr. Gatsby, but he realizes that Gatsby like has his arms stretched out towards the dark water. He's basically stretched out towards the East Egg. He says he could have sworn that he was trembling. And then the next time he looked, Gatsby was gone.
So chapter two, Nick is telling us about this thing called the Valley of Ashes that's like halfway between West Egg, well, the eggs, East Egg, West Egg, and New York City. And it's this place that's just covered in ash. The men are covered in ash. Everything is covered. It's like a dumping ground for New York City, I think. It's kind of like their garbage, I don't know, spot. And poor people live there. West Egg is new money. East Egg is old money. And then this Valley of Ashes is where the poor people live. And in it, there's this, looking on it, there's this billboard for an old eye doctor's practice that's not, no longer in practice, but it's like these yellow glasses with these big eyes looking down on the Valley of Ashes. So I'm wondering if that's going to come up later. And I think I read somewhere that was like God watching. That was like the symbol of them. But anyways, so Tom and Nick are on a train headed to the city, which I thought was kind of interesting. Like, okay, they're hanging out together again. Nick says that Tom may have had a little bit too much to drink, but he's like, we're getting off. I want you to meet my girl. So the train stops and he's like,
just kill you?
Yeah. And it's his wife's cousin. This is very weird. And so he's like almost violently takes Nick off of the train because he's been drinking a little bit, right? He says, I think he'd tanked up a good deal at luncheon and his determination to have my company bordered on vengeance. And he's like, well, I had nothing better to do, so I just went with him. They get off the train and they go to this garage. The sign says George B. Wilson repairs, George B. Wilson cars bought and sold. And so he follows Tom inside and there's the man in there. And Tom's like, hey, Wilson, how's it going? Right? He just sounds like Tom was going to sell George a car. And so George is expecting this car and he's like, is it ready? Are you going to bring it? Tom says, I've got somebody working on it right now. And Wilson says, works pretty slow, doesn't he? Then mid conversation, this woman comes down the stairs. I thought this was really interesting. He hears footsteps. He looks over. It says the thickish figure of a woman blocked out the light from the office door. She was in the middle 30s and faintly stout, but she carried her surplus flesh sensuously as some women can. I always wanted to be one of those women, just so you know.
Super curvy.
Yes, but like, it's funny because I think we're like so critical of ourselves. Some women are very curvy and also very sexy. I don't know, attractive, right? Yeah. I was totally. I'm just saying, I always wanted to be one of those women. What's funny though, is it said her face that was above her dress contained no facet or gleam of beauty. She's not even beautiful. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
But there was an immediately perceptible vitality about her, as if the nerves of her body were continually smoldering. So she's got this like life in her that is probably what's attractive to Tom.
Yeah.
But she's not beautiful, apparently. And it did say earlier that her husband is good looking, but he kind of is lacking that life.
And also he owns a garage and they've lived on top of the garage for 11 years and she's not happy about that, which for a lot of people, that would be just fine. Like that's their livelihood and he's working his butt off. And like, that's what they could do, especially in the 20s. Like,
yeah,
I don't think it was terribly uncommon for people to live above the garage where they worked, but she was not happy about that. She was better than him.
She says to her husband, why don't you go get some chairs? Like, get him out of here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go. And immediately when he gets up to leave, Tom leans over to her. He says, I want to see you get on the next train. So that's where we're at. So he's going to get back on the train and they just discuss where they're going to meet. So they leave and they're waiting for her. And I love that Nick says, doesn't her husband object? And Tom says, Wilson, he thinks she goes to see her sister in New York. He's so dumb, he doesn't know he's alive. That's pretty bad. But that could read into
that. Right, that also goes back to what you said about how like he's supposed to be this handsome guy. He's probably hardworking, but he just doesn't have that vibrancy. It's almost like he doesn't know he's alive. He's just going through the day to day, which is not his fault. Like nobody can judge him for that. He's working hard, which is something that Tom knows nothing about.
Right. So. Tom has time to go and steal other men's wives. I should stop that because we're not supposed to judge them, like you said in the beginning. just telling
it's
the story.
It's really hard. You suddenly realize how incredibly hard it is to not judge people.
Nick, the narrator, is saying like, so Tom and his girl and I, we go back to New York together, but they don't because she's riding in a different car because they don't want people to see them, I guess. So they ride the train to New York. And then when they get there, they get into a taxi, but she like lets a bunch of taxis go by before she picks one. So I don't know if she's just being picky. They all must get into the taxi together. And she sees like a guy with a basket of puppies. And I would just later love to know what the heck is up with this dog and who's watching it.
Yeah.
What's her plan?
Stuck in an apartment. I know.
Yeah. So she sees these puppies in this basket with this guy's carrying, and she knocks on the glass and she's like, I want one of those puppies. They get out. She says, I want one of those dogs. I want to get one for the apartment. They're nice to have a dog. And so this apartment that she's talking about is the one that Tom has to like meet her at in New York. And so nobody really lives there. So I don't know what she's wanting to do with this dog. And then later you get the idea that she didn't really want the dog. She thought that getting the dog was what sophisticated rich people, something that they did. And so she was just kind of...
Yeah, you get the idea throughout all of it that she is also acting. She's trying to act the part of a sophisticated woman. And I think that's really even why she, you know, let a few taxis go by before she settled on one. She thought that's what rich women did. She thought that rich women buy perfume and cold cream and magazines. Yeah. So the whole time she is also acting.
So Tom buys her this dog. And I also think it's funny too that Nick is constantly trying to get out of this situation. He's constantly trying to leave. And they're like, no, come with us. Come with us. We need you to come. The story that she uses to go to New York, you know, what she tells her husband is that she's going to see her sister. Mm-hmm. So they basically are like, you need to come with us so you can see my sister. You can meet my sister. And I think at one point it says like, she's said to be very beautiful by people who ought to know. So then the McKees come. So the little couple, and she says she's going to invite them. They're coming. Okay, so they get to the apartment, kind of explains what's in the apartment. He does tell us that he'd only been drunk twice in his life, and this was the second time. So we're being told that he's going to be very drunk, but that everybody is in the apartment. So the rest of the chapter is a little bit hazy, as if we're drunk, because the narrator.
Yeah, you know, that's a really, I hadn't actually even thought about that, but it's really true.
They ran out of cigarettes. And so Nick goes down to the store to get cigarettes. And when he comes back, Tom and Myrtle are not there. Mm-hmm. And so he just sits down and like reads a book. And then Mrs. Wilson's sister arrives. And then Mr. McKee, who is a photographer, and his wife come in. They talk a little bit about what he's like. And they say that he's in the artistic game, and that which means that he's a photographer. Then they talk about Mrs. Wilson, which is Myrtle, how she changes her, like you said, this must be like she's acting. She changes her clothes and then she changes her behavior, personality, how she's behaving. With the influence of the dress, her personality had undergone a change. The intense vitality that had been so remarkable in the garage was converted into impressive hauteur. Her laugh, her gestures, her assertions became more violently affected moment by moment. As she expanded, the room grew smaller around her until she seemed to be revolving on a noisy, creaky pivot through the smoky air. So I just think that was kind of interesting that as she changes her clothes, she changes her demeanor. That's the word I guess I was looking for. And then the next part, she talks about how she had a woman come up and look at her feet. Do you know what that means? Why would they hire somebody to come look at your feet?
I don't know. As I read that, I was like, they didn't say she did anything to her feet.
No.
Is it almost like palm reading, only it's feet reading? Like, that's the only thing I could think.
It was interesting, but she complains about how much they charge. She was like, you would think that I had gotten my appendix taken out. Yeah, I wrote down, why would someone come look at your feet? But I'd want them to at least rub them. Come on.
It is interesting too. Like, she keeps giving away more and more that she really is quite uneducated, and yet she's striving so hard to act the part of sophisticated woman. Just this sentence right here where she says, I had a woman up here last week to look at my feet. When she gave me the bill, you'd have thought she had my appendicitis out.
Yeah.
You don't get your appendicitis out. You get your appendix out, and it's you'd have thought, not you'd have thought. Anyway, so I kind of love his very subtle little changes in the grammar and their sophistication or lack thereof of their language to be like, there's a difference.
That's interesting. So then the lady, Mrs. McKee, says, I like your dress. I think it's adorable. And they kind of talk about how she thinks her husband should take Mrs. Wilson's picture. I just think it's funny too, the way the conversation goes. I can just imagine all these rich people sitting in a room talking like this. My husband should take your picture. You look really adorable. And she's like, she brushes her hair aside. And the husband is like, I think we should change the lighting. And he uses his hands to kind of like show how he would change the lighting. And the lady's like, no, I think it's perfect. The lighting's just right. So I could just imagine these people talking like this.
Me too. And also they're all very extremely pretentious. And honestly, Mr. McKee, he reminds me of Uncle Rico in Napoleon Dynamite. Because like, he keeps talking about all the ways he would like, oh, I do this to change the lighting. You know, and like, oh, have you seen my pictures of the mountains? You should see that. It's really great. You know, like, it's just like Uncle Rico always talking about how amazing he is at football and his glory days in high school. And it's like, get out of your dream world, pal. Look, because
what you said is hilarious, because he talks about these two that he'd gone out on Long Island and taken these pictures. And the two studies are called Montauk Point, the Gulls. Montauk Point, the Sea. Those are not really innovative names for your greatest pictures that you've taken, right? Catherine is Mrs. Wilson's sister. She sits down with Nick on the couch again. She says, do you live on Long Island? And he says, I live at West Egg. And then, of course, she says, really? I was down there at a party about a month ago at a man named Gatsby's. Do you know him?
There it is.
Everybody knows him. And then, okay, this starts the rumors right here. This is the first rumor. Everybody knows of him and they have all these stories about him, right? And she says, well, they say he's a nephew or a cousin of Kaiser Wilhelm's. That's where all his money comes from. Nobody knows where his money came from. Nobody knows what he does. They know he's new money. Maybe they don't know he's new money because they think it might have come from a relative, I guess. And then she says,
well, I'm Kaiser Wilhelm of Austria, like Austria-Hungary, like interesting. I don't think so.
Probably okay. Not. Catherine then leans into him and whispers about Tom and Myrtle. Neither of them can stand the person they're married to. And he says, can't they? Can't stand them. And then she says, what I say is, why go on living with them if they can't stand them? If I was them, I'd get a divorce and get married to each other right away. And what's funny is then she blames it on Daisy being Catholic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Daisy's Catholic. And they don't believe in divorce. And Nick knows that she's not Catholic.
Yeah.
Like, that's totally made up.
It totally is. And I hadn't thought about this before, but the truth is Tom would never marry Myrtle. As uppity and egotistical as he is, he would never marry her. He's all about the money and he's all about his look. Why do you think that they just go to this apartment and they stay there all day, you know? Well, I mean, he's taken her out to other places and that's true. But yeah, it would not be a good thing for his wealthy image to marry Myrtle. So
yeah, you think about that a lot in history. Like, okay, he couldn't marry her because even if he loved her, because she wasn't the right person. So he goes and marries the woman that has the right background and then he doesn't love her.
Right.
Happens all the time. Okay, I'm just going to jump to the end because I think it's very interesting. They get drunker and drunker, and Myrtle is getting drunker and drunker. And it comes up that Tom says that Mrs. Wilson doesn't have a right to mention Daisy's name, which is really funny because they can't stand each other. So why does he care if she mentions his wife's name? Well, then she's drunk and she's like, well, Daisy, 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 I'll say it whenever I want to. Daisy, Daisy. And he punches her in the nose and blood goes everywhere. And breaks
her nose. Yeah.
Yes. I don't know. It's just crazy. And nobody like does much about it. They go and the women go help her. They go clean it up. There's blood everywhere. They go in the bathroom and they have like towels and stuff. But then the other guys just leave.
Just like nothing happened.
Like, yeah. And I mean, they even go on to say, like, come to lunch someday. And he says, where? Anywhere. I don't know. It's just very funny. So they just leave the apartment. I mean, what a way to end.
This is where I have a hard time with Nick, because it seems like he should be this good character that you want to believe is a good man, and, you know, somebody who stands up for what's right and stuff. But like, he doesn't say anything to defend Daisy. He knows what the truth is, but he doesn't say anything to defend her, even when Myrtle's sister is like, oh, he can't stand her. You know, neither of them can stand their spouses. Well, they won't get divorced because Daisy is a Catholic. He knows what the truth is. Yeah. And he doesn't say anything. But maybe this goes back to his whole, don't judge people because you haven't, like, they don't have the advantages that you do. But I think that that can be taken too far, because at a point you start to lose your integrity, I believe. Because I think a man of integrity would have been like, that's not the truth. To see a woman get hit so hard her nose was broken, I don't care what era you live in, everyone knows that is wrong. To not say anything about it, to not do anything about it, I have a hard time with this guy.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, Tom is the villain, but we know he's an obvious villain. Is Nick sort of a semi-villain too, because he doesn't say or do anything? I don't know. Yeah. Again, it's also, like we said before, in classics, we see human nature and we see ourselves, we see how other people are, and how many times do we not speak up? Like, what would we do in that situation? And I think that's, it kind of gives us a vivid look. This is the narrator. It's an I. What would you do?
I sometimes think we take giving people the benefit of the doubt too far. And, you know, the idea that we shouldn't judge anybody. I mean, there comes a time when you need to, like, step in. And so where's that line, right?
Yeah. And I think that's probably an age old question. It's like, where is it? Where's going too far and where's going not far enough?
Yeah.
It's the summertime. And he just says there's music at his neighbor's house, Gatsby's house, throughout the summer nights. He says that on weekends, his Rolls Royce became an omnibus, bearing parties to and from the city between 9 a.m. and long past midnight. Okay. So he just goes in to start describing these very elaborate parties that are happening next door. Tons of caterers come in to put out just these incredible spreads with all kinds of meat and salads. The orchestra would arrive, and not just a 5-piece orchestra. It would be like a full band of woodwinds as well. The cars from New York, when the party really started, they were parked like 5 deep in the driveway. And it just said there was lots of noise and dancing. He was actually invited. What I think it was the chauffeur, somebody came over from Gatsby's house and actually gave him a personal invitation from Gatsby to one of the parties. So he went, and he said he realized that he was one of the few guests who had actually been invited, because people didn't get invited. They would just go, or they'd be taken by somebody and just show up. And anybody who'd been there before would be like, oh yeah, come on in, and then introduce them to other people, and they'd go. He listened to the people talking together. So this is his first party, okay? He listened to people talking together, and everybody seemed like they're selling something. They're like, look, everybody here is rich. This is easy money. So that's kind of the vibe of the parties. Everybody's trying to sell something. He does run into Jordan Baker and kind of hangs out with her. With her, they talk to these two girls. And one of them talks about how at the last party she came to, she had ripped her dress. Within a week, she got a package with a brand new evening gown in it that she found out cost $265. And in 1922, that is no small sum. Very expensive dress to replace it. And they were like, yeah, this guy Gatsby, he doesn't want to get into trouble with anybody. So then they kind of jump into the lore of Gatsby. Somebody told me they thought he killed a man once. He was a German spy during the war. Yeah, he grew up in Germany. No, he was in the American army during the war. But I'll bet he killed a man. He says it was testimony to the romantic speculation he inspired, Gatsby inspired, that there were whispers about him from those who had found little that it was necessary to whisper about in this world. And that does go back to what you said. They don't have any meaning. They don't have anything to do. And so they make up stories about Jay Gatsby.
Yeah.
He and Jordan go into the house because they're like, we want to actually meet this guy. Very few people at the party actually even knew what Gatsby looked like. So they go into the house and they walk into this room, which is like this gorgeous library. And there's this drunk man sitting there, and he's looking at the books. He's like, they're real. Says the books are real. And he pulls one out and like thumbs through it. It's like it's real paper and real coverings and everything. Yes, they are. And so it's just sort of a testament to how wealthy Jay Gatsby is that he has just this very prolific library.
Yeah, and he says that it wasn't what he was expecting. He wasn't expecting those books to be real.
So
it's a bona fide piece of printed matter.
Yeah. Yeah. He was expecting it to just be like cardboard boxes. Yes. It's all fake. Like most of the people there were extremely fake, but this guy, Jay Gatsby, was the real deal. Then this is really interesting. So he's still with Jordan, says that he was enjoying himself now. I had taken 2 finger bowls of champagne and the scene had changed before my eyes into something significant, elemental, and profound.
I wrote down in here, these people are ridiculous.
They really are. So like, ridiculous.
Like the guy in the library says, like he came with a lady, Claude Roosevelt. And he says, I've been drunk for a week now and I thought it might sober me up to sit in a library. Later, they keep saying like, I love this sentence. By midnight, the hilarity had increased. Like it just keeps getting worse and worse and more like, I don't want to say chaotic, but like.
I would say so. It like just people got a lot more drunk, I think.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
Just their level of crazy went up exponentially. When he realizes that he's having a much better time and that everything surrounding him suddenly looks so much better because he's had lots of drinks, he's sitting at a table with a man about his age. And the man says, your face is familiar. Weren't you in the 3rd Division during the war? And Nick says, yes, I was in the 9th Machine Gun Battalion. So they make this connection. They realize, you know, they probably saw each other. They were serving. And this guy says, hey, I just bought a hydroplane. Why don't you go fly it with me tomorrow morning? We find out. So this is really funny because Nick says, this is an unusual party for me. I haven't even seen the host. I live over there. And this man Gatsby sent over his chauffeur with an invitation. For a moment, the man looked at me as if he failed to understand. I'm Gatsby, he said suddenly. What? Oh, I beg your pardon. It's not Nick's fault. Like, he doesn't know. He never really seen him. He kind of saw the back of him, sort of a silhouette, but that isn't helpful. Gatsby, instead of letting him feel embarrassed, he gives him a smile, an understanding smile. It was one of those rare smiles with a quality of eternal reassurance in it you may come across 4 or 5 times in life. And then he describes him. He says, I was looking at an elegant young roughneck, a year or two over 30, whose elaborate formality of speech just missed being absurd. He was picking his words with care. He is also acting, isn't he? He's being very careful about his speech so that it will sound like he is old money, like he's sophisticated, yep. Like he belongs, right?
Yeah, I wrote down Gatsby is new money. So he has to pretend like he knows how to act.
Exactly. When Gatsby leaves, he asks Jordan like who he is. And she's just like, I don't know. Somebody told me he was an Oxford man. And then she says, but I don't believe it. So he looks up at Gatsby, who's sort of standing on the marble steps and looking out at everybody. And speaking of drinking, Nick says that it's pretty apparent that Gatsby is not drinking. He's not drinking anything. He says, I wondered if the fact that he was not drinking helped to set him off from his guests, for it seemed to me that he grew more correct as the fraternal hilarity increased. So in a way, it was like, hey, you guys drink everything and I'm not going to, and this will make me seem a lot more, again, sophisticated and above the rest. The end of the party comes. He feels a little bit foolish because he's like one of the last ones there. It turns out to be just fine. He says he feels like it was actually a good thing that he was one of the last ones there. And Gatsby like reiterates his invitation for going out in the hydroplane the next morning. And as he's leaving, he's like, the party is kind of continuing because there's like this whole line of cars. Everybody's honking. There's a car off into the ditch. And we find out that it's the drunk man in the library and another driver, they just like run into this wall and their wheel came off and they're so drunk. They thought they were still moving. They didn't know that they're like collapsed in this ditch and there's like holding up traffic somehow. People are like, okay, your wheel is not attached to your car. You can't. They're like, can't we just back it out? No, you can't. It's so funny and it's so pathetic. They're just completely just wasted. But it's just sort of typical for these crazy people. The party's over. Time goes on. Nick says that he starts to like New York. He sort of has his regular routine. He hadn't seen Jordan Baker for a while. And then they kind of met up again. And he realized that she was incurably dishonest. He sees all these things that she does, and then he remembers why he had heard her name before and seen her picture. It was because she was in this newspaper article about something that was almost a scandal because she had lied during a golf game. But I think this is interesting. He said, "It made no difference to me. Dishonesty in a woman is a thing you never blame deeply." Anyway, they're going on a drive together, and he's like, "You are a horrible driver." She's like, "I'm careful." "No, you're not." "Well, other people are." You know, and it's just this attitude that everybody else needs to watch out for me, which is typical of all this class. It's not my problem. It's everybody else's. So the last couple lines in this chapter, I think, are really interesting. "Everyone suspects himself of at least one of the cardinal virtues, and this is mine. I am one of the few honest people that I have ever known." And I think it kind of begs the question, is he though? Wouldn't it have been honest for him to say Daisy's not Catholic? Or it's not okay to hit a woman? Or a lot of times dishonesty is wrapped up in omission. Maybe you don't tell a blatant lie, but you also don't tell the truth.
Yeah, but what does that say about everybody else too?
Oh, absolutely.
Right, like everybody's complete liars or something. Yeah, and he's almost like, maybe it's more like, I'm the only one here that doesn't have secrets.
Well, and I think that he's the only one there that's also not acting. At least I don't think so.
We'll find out, I guess.
Yeah. Lots of stuff in there, you guys.
I know. Who knew? When I first read it, I was like, oh, it's not A Tale of Two Cities, that's for sure. But there's still a lot in it.
Yeah. Jam-packed.
Okay. Do you know what book you want to share?
So I just read, listen to, Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. Have you read that one?
No, but I want to know what you think, if I should read it.
I really, really enjoyed it. I'd seen it everywhere and I'd seen it recommended. One of my friends had posted about it and stuff. And I was like, I don't know. Because I think when people recommend it and it's recommended everywhere and it's super popular, I like have this switch in my brain that's like, no. But I tried it and I really, really liked it. So it's really sweet. Like there's a lot of hard stuff in it, but it's also really sweet. Part of it is told in first person, and that first person is a Pacific octopus.
That's what turned me off. But
know,
then everybody else is like, it's so good. And so I'm like,
yeah,
and it's an octopus.
No, that's totally why I was like, no. But I think if you tried it, you'd find you really liked it. And then the narrator, third person narrator, tells the story of this sweet little lady, Tova, who is a widow. And she's really quite well off, but she wants something to do. She wants meaning in her life. And so she took a job as a cleaner at the aquarium. And they are in the Pacific Northwest, which I guess also is, I was like, oh, I love it. Now it's up near the Puget Sound. So it's not like
Oregon.
Oregon, but still like the same weather, a lot of the same, you know, look to things. So she's just this immaculate cleaner. So she loves to clean, but she sort of like forms this relationship with this old dying octopus, and it's really sweet. And then we also get the story of this young man who lives in California. He's from Modesto, California, and he was abandoned by his mother when he was 9 years old. He never knew who his father was, and at this point he's about 30, and he's pretty angry at his dad because he's like, how could he just leave? He never helped with child support, never helped with anything. He was actually raised by his aunt, who's just like this crazy trailer park lady. Like, he's super intelligent, he's a decent guy, but he's very shiftless. Like, he can't hold a job because he's just kind of shiftless. So he actually gets a lead on who his dad might be, and so which takes him right to the same town where little Tova and this octopus are, and this funny tiny little town in Western Washington, and just all the characters there. And it's quite the journey. And I really loved it.
Oh,
it was fun. There was some language in it, but it was a good story.
Yeah. A lot of people I've heard that's like their favorite book of the year or whatever. It was so good. And I was like, I just don't know if I can do an octopus narrator.
The thing is though, he is a first person narrator, but his parts are very short and very sparse. It's not very frequent, but what he says is just like short and impactful. So, okay.
All right. So I have been reading The Downstairs Girl by Stacy Lee. I have to confess that I read probably half of it and had to start over. because I wasn't paying attention. I was like, read. I was listening to it. So I was like, I don't know what's going on. So I just started over and I actually am liking it. I'm like understanding what's going on now. But about this little Chinese girl that doesn't have parents. So she's kind of been raised by this other Chinese man. And they live in an underground railroad house.
Oh, okay.
But the people upstairs don't know they live there.
Oh my gosh.
And so they have to be very careful and very quiet. The people upstairs run like a newspaper and they can hear everything that's going on upstairs. And so they listen in on them, right? Well, the newspaper is afraid that it's going to go under. And so this little Chinese girl starts up an anonymous, like they don't know who's writing this, but she starts this thing called the Miss Sweetie column. So it's like, Dear Abby. And it's really cute. And like nobody, if they knew that she was Chinese, nobody, you know what I mean? It would be over. And she kind of has a crush on the boy upstairs that's also he's a reporter for the newspaper. I mean, he's also the son of the people who run the newspaper. But, and so she's like constantly trying to stay anonymous. So yeah, like at one point she comes upstairs and she always like turns her back so he can't see her. And so he says, it's nice to see that you're back and you're back, like your backside. When her column becomes wildly popular, she uses the power of the pen to address some of society's ills. That's the other thing is she writes things that she's afraid people are going to be upset about, like women voting. And anyways, so she uses her column to challenge ideas about race and gender. I really liked it the second time because I paid attention. But do you ever get like 5 hours into a book and you're like, I have no idea what's going on?
That probably means that you've got a lot of other things going on in your brain.
That's right. I'm not thinking. Aww. So anyways, and then I'm like, okay, I'm going to start over and I'm going to really listen. So I did. And I liked it.
That sounds so good. So the downstairs girl.
Yeah. And you know what's funny? Okay. It says she also wrote Under a Painted Sky. And the funny thing is I have that on my TBR. Like I screenshotted a picture of it and had no idea it was by her. And I actually have no idea why I screenshotted it. Two girls hidden in plain sight. One daring journey to freedom. I'll have to look that one up now. How to make yourself pay attention while you're listening to an audiobook.
Oh, try to clear other things from your head, which good luck, I guess.
Right, exactly.
We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss The Great Gatsby chapters 4-6. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share a podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.